Greetings, 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the topic of our show is financial imperialism, the case of Russia. I've been talking about finance and imperialism for quite some time on the show and in my writings. Especially since the events of in Greece, remember the Greece crisis and how financial imperialism worked within the Eurozone during that crisis in 2010-12, and then of course also back in 2014-15 when the first Ukraine crisis emerged here with the coup and the responses to it. And I'd like to talk a little bit more here today about how we see the template of financial imperialism work now very clearly. All the options are being used to financially devastate Russia and as part of the imperial U.S. Empire measures in general. Okay, so let's talk about financial imperialism. By the way, this is like an addendum to the last show a couple of weeks ago, which was about the U.S. Wars of Imperialism, in which I described how imperialism works in its various ways, not just militarily, not just politically, but also in new ways in the 21st century, as the global, as the capitalist economy has been globalized and integrated financially and in terms of goods flows, of course, the nature of imperialism itself changes and has been more integrated and, of course, more financialized. So the meaning and explanation of imperialism has to be more financial. Oriented as well as traditional ways. There are a lot of narratives about what's going on in the Ukraine. You know, people should just step back and realize that wars are never really the good guy and the bad guy. They're all bad guys. They're all involved and all responsible for the actual physical event called the war. No side when war breaks out is absolved from their contribution to the whole event. And that's true today, as in all wars. In many ways, it looks like August 1914, where the sides stumbled, misread each other, underestimated the intentions of their adversary, overestimated the power of their own military and economic influence, and just made bad decisions. In wars, it's very difficult to understand exactly what's going to happen. A lot of unknowns occur on both sides, and as both sides' estimations of what will be done turns out not to be true, they get dragged even further into the conflict, and we can see that slowly happening here on both sides in the Ukraine. Lots of narratives as to what's actually going on here. In the Western media, you're not going to get a true picture. It's very propagandized. And the same in the Russian media on the other side. Very propagandized treatments of what's reported to folks. And both sides sanctioning each other and cutting off each other, so that people in both places aren't able to get a true picture. That's so that the elites can do what they want. Lots of different narratives, and I'd just like to give you mine before we get into the financial analysis, the financial imperialism, and how it's working in this case. The way I see this thing is that all parties are responsible. The U.S. is the initiator of this, I believe, going back years. I believe that the U.S. Has purposely misled the Ukrainians as to what they can do or would do for the Ukrainians. I'm not just talking about, you know, sending jets from Poland or whatever, or but, you know, I think it's pretty clear. They laid out the plumb of UE membership and NATO membership and military support for Ukraine and so forth, which led naive politicians like Zelensky into thinking he had full backing from U.S. and NATO, when really not true. The U.S. May have extended NATO membership to Ukraine only if the Russians hadn't invaded. But as soon as they did, NATO membership, of course, was totally off the board. The U.S., once Biden got into office here as far back as July, began upping the ante and taunting Russia, taunting it by engaging in military direct exercises with Ukraine, by providing U.S. military advisors and arms, by signing an agreement intending to bring, this was last November, Ukraine into the European Union with a promise of NATO, refusing to say no publicly that they would not agree to bring Ukraine into NATO, and generally allowing Zelensky to run amok, saying things he should never have said, like, oh, we want nuclear arms next after that, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the U.S. Played Zelensky like a violin and let him go and run amok, saying things while they gave indications they might support Ukraine to the hilt, which of course they never would and will. And that taunted Russia, I think, and forced Russia's hand here. Made it easy, since Russia and Putin really want to restore hegemony on his borders, which it thinks it is challenged. You can't forget what happened in Georgia, and I think it was 2008, and the U.S. Instigated invasion, green light given to, I think his name was Saakashvili, to invade Ossetia, a Russian province, which didn't work out too well for him. But if you go back, this whole thing begins in 1999, when you got Bill Clinton, who's very weakened, almost got impeached, and willing to do anything that the Republicans and business interests wanted. And, of course, domestically he did that, opened a door that when George Bush got in, he just kicked open and passed a lot of what Clinton had allowed domestically. But more important, you know, we see in 1999, Clinton agrees for NATO to bomb the hell out of Serbia and Kosovo, which kind of puts to rest this whole thing that NATO is a defensive alliance. It certainly wasn't in Serbia, and it certainly wasn't in Libya, and it certainly wasn't in other places. NATO is not simply a defensive alliance. In any event, it starts with Bill Clinton. And immediately Bill Clinton not only agrees to bombing of Serbia, but he also agrees to quickly bring the northern East European countries into NATO, Poland, Czech Republic, I think Slovakia at the time, I'm not sure. negating a promise that the U.S. had made in early 1990s when the Soviet Union broke up, not to move NATO east. And at the time in 1999, you know, the dean of U.S. foreign policy, George F. Kennan, and the formulation of the post-World War II status quo warned strongly against moving NATO east. And as did a number of other U.S. ambassadors at the time, even in the Democratic Party. They warned what would happen is what's happening now. So a very weak president being threatened with impeachment, willing to do whatever the military-industrial complex and the corporate elite behind them really wanted to do, the generals did open the door. So this goes back to Clinton. And then, of course, George W. Bush pushes the envelope even further. And I think it was 2004 or 5, brings the southern East European into NATO, countries into NATO, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary. Or maybe Hungary was before, I'm not sure. But anyway, you have the whole Eastern Europe, short of the Baltics, now part of NATO. Violating the agreements given to Russia. Of course, Russia is too weak at the time. It can't do much about it. It just went through a terrible decade of the economic depression and disorganization following the collapse of the Soviet Union throughout most of the 1990s. And the U.S. uses the opportunity to also support the first Orange Revolution. In Ukraine, I think that was 2005, right? It's after the Georgia War, I think it was 2008, however, where the U.S. Interests, as I said, instigated, incentivized Georgia to invade South Russia, and of course they lost that. John McCain was the big pusher behind that one. And that raised even more concern in Russian circles. And then, of course, you have the 2014 coup d'etat, very blatantly a U.S. intervention there. Victoria Nuland, Undersecretary of State and for running Eastern Europe for the U.S. State Department under Obama. Now Obama, of course, is going along with the policy of extending NATO, as well as George Bush. Victoria Nuland brags, publicly got caught saying that, you know, we spent $5 billion here to bring upon this coup and pull it off, which they did, and she bragged about it. And of course, they used the pro-Nazi ground forces there, the Banderas. In Western Ukraine, always been strong. Fascists have always been strong in Western Ukraine throughout the first two world wars and used them as shock troops to pull off the insurrection there, drive out the elected president who was trying to be more neutral. You know, the whole thing instigated over the then president attempting to trade with both Europe and with Russia. He wanted the same kind of terms for Europe and Russia, but the nationalists did not want anything to do with trading with Russia, wanted just to trade with the West, and that's what kind of provoked the whole thing. That was like in November, December 2013. Folks interested in this history, I'm not going to go any deeper, can read my article on my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I trace some of this history in the piece entitled 10 Reasons Why the U.S. May Want Russia to Invade Ukraine. So after that, of course, Russia responded by trying to break off the two eastern provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, and seize the Crimea. Okay, so that was where things were as 2015, maybe 16. And then, of course, the election 2016 comes up in the U.S. and Russia interferes, electronically here in some ways with the election, which just pisses off the Democrats who believe that Hillary would have won if it wasn't for that. Whether that's true or not, that's what they believe. Okay, so you've got this situation where the Democrats are just seething with having lost to Donald Trump, blaming the Russians for it. So then as soon as Biden wins, within months after passing the domestic COVID relief legislation, Biden and Democrats turn directly to up in the ante in the Ukraine. They stage military exercises with Ukrainian forces on Ukrainian ground. They leave all kind of advisors there. They provide military support surreptitiously to the Ukrainians. And one of the reasons why the Ukrainians are doing better than they thought was no doubt American advisors and American flying radar telling them where all the other forces are and satellites that are helping them intercept the Russian forces going on now. So very deep, deepening U.S. military involvement in Ukraine. At the same time, the U.S. is slowly pulling out of these anti-ballistic missile and intermediate missile deals that they had under Reagan and Gorbachev, which is another signal. And the U.S. refuses publicly to say that they have no intention of bringing NATO into the Ukraine. In fact, their communiques kind of suggest that that's the next step. And then in November, Biden signs a deal with Zelensky that says just that, that they are initiating the steps to bring Ukraine into the EU and then into NATO. Well, that was kind of the last straw. Meanwhile, Zelensky is running amok talking about, well, we also need to restore nuclear weapons here in Ukraine once we're in NATO, and freaks out the Russians. I think the U.S. was taunting the Russians, to invade, because there's a lot to be gained and is being gained already from the U.S. dealing with a war in the Ukraine. A proxy war, a classic proxy war here where the U.S. is not really committing forces. Those are the kind of wars the U.S. typically wins. When it has to get directly involved, it doesn't win very often, a.k.a. Vietnam. What you've got here is a taunting of the Russians and the Russians coming in. And the U.S. has already prevailed in several of its strategic objectives. The U.S. Is using, I believe, Ukraine to launch these sanctions to drive Russia out of Western Europe. I think that's the big objective. Drive it out of the economy. It was getting too deeply involved in the economy in Europe and therefore increasing its political leverage with the Europeans, especially during the Trump years. Trump pretty much did nothing with regard to confronting Russian interests. Quite the opposite, and Russians knew it, and did deepen their economic and political influence within Europe, particularly Germany, and that was fracturing the NATO alliance significantly. So the U.S. Wanted to drive Russia out of Europe altogether to restore U.S. hegemony over NATO, which it has done. That's done. That's a done deal. And when this thing is over, the move will begin to bring Finland and Sweden and Moldova and others into the NATO structure, I believe, and then watch events, the U.S. to use the same template it's been using in Ukraine to use it in Belarus. That will be the next target. So the U.S. has gained significantly, getting control over Europe, driving the Russians out of Western Europe, or Europe in general. And of course, that means U.S. Economic interests move in and reap the economic benefits of all that, replacing the Russians. It will be a not easy transition. Europeans will pay the price economically for it. But that's what's going to happen. So it's not just U.S. strategic global political gains here of, you know, restoring hegemony over NATO under its leadership, but it's also economic gains for U.S. capitalists that come in behind, particularly the oil and gas companies who will replace Russian oil and gas. Right? To some extent, maybe the Middle Eastern economies will do the same. Qatar and Saudi Arabia will provide gas and oil. Although, Bin Salman there in Saudi's is playing his poker hand here. Amazingly, wouldn't even talk to Biden when Biden said he wanted a conversation. Bin Salman wants is more U.S. aid to go after Yemen. The Yemenis are going to pay a big price now. And also U.S. technical help to build nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia, and other military aid as well. That's what's going on there in the stalling of discussing increasing production, oil production, out of Saudi, and gas production, right, from Qatar in the UAE. They will get some of their increased gas and oil from the Saudis and the Emirates, they meaning Europe, but it won't be overnight. Well, maybe the oil could be sooner, but certainly not the gas. The facilities need to be expanded there, and that'll take a year to 2 years to do so. Also, the U.S. will have to increase its investments in liquid natural gas ports in Europe, and that won't happen overnight either. So chronic high inflation is going to be a constant fact for at least a year or two in Europe. Excess inflation due to energy costs always leads to deep recessions. It happened in 73, 74. It happened in 80, 81, in 90, 91. And it happened in 2008. Whenever you see $100 a barrel oil shoot up this fast and stay there, then you are looking at a recession, because it takes a big whack out of consumer spending. When consumers have to pay for extra gas and other costs related to oil and gas, utilities, etc., they can't spend on other real goods. So consumer spending, in a real sense, slows down and even contracts. And the same thing with a lot of businesses. The costs rise so far that they have to cut off their investment. And many go under because their margins are too narrow, and the cost increase in oil and fuel is just too much. So business investment and just the uncertainty of the war will stifle business investment, and the inflation will stifle both in business investment and consumer spending, and that's how these historic rises in oil prices come back and whack the real economy and slow it down. So we're on the cusp of that, I believe, happening again. My narrative is the U.S. is the instigator of this, and it's been building for quite some time. And Biden and the Democrats, began their payback for the 2016 election. I'm not saying that's the only cause, but I'm saying that's part of the picture here in the second half of 2021. And a lot to be gained by the U.S., not only NATO recontrol, and driving Russia out of Europe so American business can step in. But these sanctions mean they're seizing a lot of assets, a lot of Russian assets. The banks, the U.S. banks are seizing these assets, the central bank and the private banks. And what the banks seize, they do not give up. You know, just ask Venezuela, where their gold reserves were snatched. And they still don't get it back, and they will never get them back. It's kind of like imperial piracy, you see. That's part of this thing, a new form of piracy where you just smash and grab, you might say, kind of like a thief going into a jewelry store and smashing, the windows and grabbing what they can and run. Well, that's what the banks are doing now with these sanctions. Russia had $680 billion, I think, in assets, about $300 billion or so. Those were still held in liquid form, gold and currencies and so forth, in offshore banks, and now all those are frozen. So that's a big windfall for the banks, you see. That's their share of the imperial booty here, financial imperial booty. The oil companies, of course, their share is going to be in the price increases out here in California, already $6.50 a gallon, soon going to $7, and even further than that, I believe, here as the spring goes on. That's a massive income transfer, income redistribution, you see, from average consumers to the oil companies. Massive. And the same with other companies that are near monopoly companies, raising their prices for their food and so forth, because a fourth of all the global wheat and corn comes out of Ukraine and Russia. So those commodities are going through the roof as well. Russia is not only providing 40% of oil to Europe, 30% of oil to Europe, and 40% of natural gas. And of course, that's even higher in Germany. But also industrial metals, you see. Industrial metals like palladium, that's necessary for catalytic converters, and nickel, that's necessary for batteries. Electric car batteries, or batteries in general, Russia has a large proportion of the global production there, and that's going to be all cut off. Nickel prices shot up last week 250% one day, and they had to shut down the metals market because of it. So, all these costs are going through the roof now. And, you know, if you're a car company, you just tack it onto the price of your automobile. You know, if you're a monopolistic company, you can do that. You know, if you're a small restaurant, of course, you can't do that. Right? It's very difficult. If you raise the price of food, then people just don't come, especially since they're paying more for gas. So there's a lot of blowback from these sanctions coming back on Europe and the U.S., but mostly at the expense of small businesses and consumers. But I think, what we got here is a three-way war with the Ukrainians in the middle bearing the brunt of the damage economically. And, I mean, even if it ended tomorrow, so much of the infrastructure in Ukraine has been destroyed. How will they even get it going again is another question. At what cost? And is the U.S. going to provide so many more tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine? Well, it will provide more for sure. Because since 2014, U.S. interests have, economic interests have really deepened their presence in Europe, I mean in Ukraine, very deep. U.S. Businesses have come in and acquired companies, set up companies, operations, and so forth, including the Bidens. You know, it's true. There's some truth to that narrative that, Biden's son here is. But it's not just Biden's son. There's all kinds of relatives of the elites in the U.S. That are participating on boards and in businesses in the Ukraine. Right. So the integration is very deep over the last 8 years. Into Ukraine. Victoria Nuland, was a hedge fund or Iniquity, I forget, out of Chicago, her firm, you know, before she became under Clinton, the head of the State Department in Eastern Europe. And she's still playing the game, you see. She's still there doing that. That's how these people move in and out of government and business and in the process aid and assist their businesses back in the United States. Okay. For a time there, Victoria Nuland was not only the top official for the State Department, but became the economic czar after 2014, the economic czar of the Ukraine. In other words, we're responsible for all the economic policies. You don't think she opened the doors to U.S. business? Well, she sure did, right? So, you know, it's just not only military cooperation growing in the Ukraine, but also economic integration growing. And then Putin takes the bait and invades. And, you know, all the consequences, the benefits for the U.S. Economically and U.S. capitalists follow that whole scenario. So, you know, in my view, it's a three-way circus, and not very funny, of course. All three parties are responsible. It's an inter-capitalist food fight. Okay, it's an inter-capitalist war. You got the oligarchs on the Russian side, you know, who are tightly integrated with Putin. And you've got on the other side the oligarchs in the U.S. Yes, we have oligarchs that, you know, make the Russian oligarchs look like small stuff here. Of course, they're much better in hiding in the U.S. their wealth, and they aren't as conspicuous about flaunting their wealth. But the oligarchs drive policy in the U.S. as well, and they're winning you know, great gains in the U.S. as a consequence of this war as well, not just foreign profits now because of rising commodity prices, but, you know, for they're going to resurrect more offshore drilling, the Alaskan wildlife, North Shore is going to open up even further. There's going to be more fracking. There's going to be more, maybe even some of the pipelines. I don't know, maybe even Keystone. Not likely, because they don't really need the Canadian tar sands oil, which is very expensive. And but with the price of oil now so high, you know, it may be economical now to expand the tar sands in northern Canada there, and which means if you expand it, you need Keystone. Okay. So that's all going to happen. We're already seeing the beginning of austerity here. You know, they just passed, Congress just passed a $13.5 billion initial aid to the Ukraine, military aid. Half of that, by the way, was just the cost of moving U.S. military hardware to Eastern Europe. But at the same stroke of the pen, they take $15 billion away from COVID relief and COVID preparation here, you know, for tests and vaccines and preparation for the next wave. They just took it out of the bill they just passed, and increased by roughly the same amount the money that's thrown at the Ukraine. So that's austerity, you see, when you cut social spending and you up you pass it on to military spending. Well, that's a big gain for these capitalists running the show in the U.S. as well. They're getting their way domestically, you see, as well as internationally. If you want to find out, you know, who's behind something, just follow the money. You know, who benefits from this? And you'll see the forces that are involved in it, pretty much. Okay, so, you know, that's my narrative. Let's talk now about the financial imperialism going on, you know, in the case of Russia here. The first thing about financial imperialism is to destroy the currency of your adversary, right? Make it worthless or drive down its value. Because when you do that, the ability to finance their domestic economy gets exceedingly difficult. They're not able to import critical things they need, right? When the currency is collapsed and it costs far, far more, if it has collapsed, it's unstable. The wealth of the moneyed interest, the wealthy interest in the adversary countries disappears, because then their assets are worth far less when their currency collapses. So the idea is to financial imperialism is to prevent access to the global markets for the purpose of destroying the currency. You put sanctions on these sales of exports, which means that they're unable to earn foreign currencies, especially dollars. You see, Russia is very dependent on global oil sales. I think like 90% of its government budget is financed by oil. And if you're that dependent on oil, 85% of all sales of all crude oil are made in dollars. So if you want to sell, right, your oil, you got to have dollars. Well, you deny, if you want to buy a lot of goods in the West, you got to earn dollars to buy it. People don't want to take rubles, right? The demand for rubles collapses. And of course, the collapsing exchange rate, the currency, also undermines the value of the currency. And that's what's going on. Now, you want to, financial imperialism, you know, that's the classic way of denying dollars and driving down the domestic currency as a result. Because the dollar is the global trading currency. It is the linchpin to the global economic empire, right? As long as people are trading in dollars, buying and selling in dollars, especially oil and energy, you're in the catbird seat if it's the dollar is your currency. And of course, that's the case still. Very little relative use of euros, and even less use of yuan and Japanese yen, and the rest is just other countries' currency is insignificant. Okay, so deny export sales. You can do that by sanctions too, you see. But if you drive down the currency and prevent a country from accessing dollars, they can't buy the exports, right? And then on top of that, the U.S. has slapped these sanctions on countries exporting and or importing goods, real goods and services. So it's like a double whammy. Destroy the currency, drive down the currency, and then at the same time prevent buying whatever goods and services with the currency that they've already accumulated. Now, remember, you know, Russia had accumulated $680 billion in liquid assets, gold and so forth, that they could use, but the U.S. has snatched half of that. So they've got maybe a wealth fund of $300 billion domestically that they could use to purchase foreign goods. Well, you slap the sanctions to prevent them even using what they still have to buy foreign goods, critical goods, right? Technology goods or health goods, you know, medicines, food goods, etc., consumer goods, right? You prevent that from happening on top of denying them access to currency. Well, when you get the U.S. Central Bank seizing Russian assets and other central banks, in other words, swaps, then you're denying them currency in order to carry on their business, right? And then you slap the sanctions on top of that, right? You freeze their other liquid assets, right? You prevent foreign direct investment going into those countries, into Russia. This is another way, right? You tell U.S. businesses they got to get out of Russia, which they're doing. They're not going in anymore, investing and expanding, because when you go in and invest, you got to bring money. You got to bring your dollars that you then exchange for rubles to do business in Russia. And the same thing, if you're in Russia and you're doing business, whether you're, you know, McDonald's selling hamburgers, right? You're bringing in dollars and you're exchanging them at the Russian Central Bank for rubles and other in order to pay your cost of doing business and so forth. So by driving companies, U.S. companies and Western Europe becomes out of Russia, you're denying them currency. You're denying Russia currency. You're denying it euros and dollars, right? And by saying U.S. and Europeans cannot invest in Russia, you're doing the same thing. You're preventing the inflow of foreign currencies, and especially dollars, at the same time. All of that is designed to drive down the value of the currency, and if the currency collapses, then the stock markets collapse, right? And by the way, you prevent Western investors from buying Russian equities, Russian stocks, right, or Russian bonds, including sovereign bonds. Any way that Russia could get its hands on foreign currencies or use the foreign currencies and dollars and gold it has, you try to stop that. But financial imperialism, it's all designed to crush access to currencies and especially dollars. You could see that very clear in what they did in Venezuela, right? They told U.S. companies to get out of Venezuela, which they did. They prevented investments in Venezuela. This was several years back, right? U.S. seized Citgo, name of the Venezuela oil distribution company in the United States. It seized it, froze all its assets because Citgo would earn dollars, you see. And then it slapped sanctions, which weren't all that enforceable, on Venezuela. Venezuela also extremely dependent on oil sales in order to generate currency, which it would use to buy medicines and food and so forth on global trade, right? What could Venezuela do? Well, it just, without dollars, it just kept printing its own bolivar, domestic currency. And the more you print of that, the more it loses its value. And if it loses its value, the more domestic inflation you get, you see. So you generate inflation, and that slows down the economy and creates stagflation and popular unrest, and then you, as the imperial power, you move to do whatever else you need to do to finance the opposition to overthrow the government. Right? Didn't get that far or very successfully in Venezuela, largely because of Russia and China willing to trade and buy Venezuelan oil to keep it from collapsing. See, Venezuela would have collapsed long ago without that help. Another reason why U.S. would like to go after Russia, neutralize Russia. You know, it keeps ringing in my ear, the RAND report in 2015 after the coup there in Ukraine. The RAND report very clearly said, you know, RAND Corporation is, you know, a big military think tank. For the U.S. government and the Pentagon. The RAND Corporation did a paper that said that if you want to go, before the U.S. can go after China and Taiwan, it has to neutralize Russia. 2015. Think of that. Think about that. Well, this might be a neutralizing of Russia going on as a player, global, because these sanctions aren't going to go away. You see, even if they have a deal tomorrow, it's not going to go away. And if Russia agrees to a partial deal, an armistice, you watch NATO then come in the Western Ukrainian half. You know, the country may get partitioned. That's a possibility here. But the U.S. will then quickly bolster Russia. the Western part. Back to financial imperialism. First thing to recap here, destroy the currency. Lots of ways to do that. You simply prevent them access to dollars, and that goes a long way. You snatch all their dollars and other short-term assets like liquid assets like gold and so forth, deny foreign direct investment, force U.S. companies out, all that denies a currency, right? And, of course, without the currency, collapses, the value of the currency falls, and that has a reverberation effect on the financial asset market, stock and bond markets, which causes them to contract as well. You deny Russian companies and banks access to Western credit. Well, that's the same thing. Deny them access to currencies, to Western currencies, particularly dollars, right? Don't let them get their hands on dollars. You squeeze them in all kinds of ways. You seize their liquid assets, which we talked about, not just the central bank to central bank or bank to bank assets, but individual bank accounts too, right? You prevent credit cards, which be a way of spending based upon foreign currency, but it's all, of course, debt-based, right? You seize their ships and their planes. Also has a double effect of interfering with their trade, right? You force financial asset markets to deflate, stocks and bonds and so forth. You deny them access to the international SWIFT payment system. That's another development that we know about. This is how payments are made, even if you had the currency, right? And you see who is violating the sanctions through the SWIFT system. That's how the U.S. can engineer its squeeze, you might say. The SWIFT system is very important to it, right? You deny the country access to IMF loans when the currency collapses in countries. You know, Argentina, we've seen this and elsewhere. They get IMF loans temporarily in order to, bridge the gap until their currency can stabilize. Well, you prevent them from getting IMF loans. At the same time, you shut down World Bank projects in the country that would have brought dollars into the country, right? You provoke defaults. Defaults would have the effect of making the cost of bailout even more expensive. What do? You just let these companies default and let the contagion, well, that's what the West would like to see. They would like to see defaults and contagion within the financial system within that country, right? You delist the country, Russia, corporations from participating on global stock exchanges, because that's where you raise cash as well. You know, you issue stock and you raise cash. So you cut off loans, credit, bonds, right? You cut off stock equity access, and you seize what's out there, and you slap sanctions on top of it all, to prevent what they already have from being used, but you shut down their access to liquid assets elsewhere. Now, you know, I believe this is a very risky thing for them, them meaning U.S. and NATO, because it's a highly globalized, integrated, and financially integrated capitalist economy today. So it's pretty hard to prevent blowback and negative feedback effects. We're already seeing this, of course, with the sanctions, which haven't even been implemented yet on oil and gas. And we see record inflation already. But, you know, the oil companies and other monopolistic companies in the U.S. it doesn't bother them. They just pass the cost of the higher prices on to the consumer. Who pays for it is the consumer, you know. These companies, and small businesses that have no way of passing on the higher costs. And financial instability and collapsing values of assets has a negative effect across the board globally. And it causes companies who can't weather the storm to go bankrupt, to default on their loans and their bonds that they've already issued. Default simply means that the company can't meet the payments for principal and interest on their debt, be it corporate bonds or other instruments or loans, bank loans. They can't pay it. They can't pay the principal and interest. If you don't pay it, you've defaulted. You get 30, sometimes 60 days to come up with a solution. But after that, the lenders can take you to court and seize your assets, and that's the end of your company, right? So defaults are failure to meet principal and interest payments. Now, why do companies default? Well, it may be because they don't have sufficient revenue to pay the principal and interest. Okay, or it means their cost for their existing revenue structure rises, and they have insufficient revenue as a result as well. Insufficient revenue because they can't sell things. Insufficient revenue because their costs go up. Right, therefore they don't have enough liquid assets in order to pay their principal and interest on all their debt. Sometimes they can get the bank to roll over that debt and avoid the crisis, but at a certain point, the banks say, no, we're not going to reissue any new loans or new debt here to cover the old debt, principal and interest that you can't pay. Then you're bankrupt. And what happens when you get widespread bankruptcies like this, there's a big contagion effect. It spills across all other kinds of businesses and sectors of the economy until you get a financial crisis. Well, what are the default candidates here? Well, Russian sovereign bonds are one. You could see Russia suspend payments on its bonds, which means companies that have bought those bonds in the West, other banks and so forth, have to register the losses of the failure to pay the interest on those bonds that they're holding. So that's how the contagion works, you see. The debt really spills over to whoever holds the financial assets. In Europe, you got banks in that category that are in trouble, particularly UniCredit in Italy, Raiffeisen Bank in Austria, and the Societe Generale, maybe even Deutsche Bank in France and Germany. Italy and its sovereign bonds are also going to be the first sovereign bonds in trouble in the West. I'll repeat a Greece of a decade ago, maybe. In the USA, it's bond markets. The municipal bond markets is really under great stress right now. We could see a repeat of the repo markets, of treasuries. Same thing happened. Companies with junk bonds and leverage loans, which are junk loans, could be in trouble as well as cost rises and their revenue falls, you see. Stocks, exchange-traded funds that are heavily involved in investments in Russian assets and Russian financial instruments are also very much at risk here. We call them ETFs, that's stocks, you know. And then companies that are very sensitive to commodity cost increases, you know, cost of oil, nickel, palladium. Airplane leasing companies, you know, there's hundreds of airplanes that are sitting on the ground in Russia. How are they going? These leasing companies, airlines don't own their airplanes. It's leasing companies that own their airplanes. How are they going to deal with those losses? In the rest of the world, you got the what's now the dollarized bond markets. In other words, companies have borrowed in dollars at interest rates based upon what's happening with the Federal Reserve. And as the Federal Reserve raises the rates, then the interest payments rise for these companies that borrowed in dollars. Latin America is particularly exposed there. currency exchange rate sensitive countries, you know, as the dollar rises, which it will and is, then the exchange rates reciprocally collapse in all the other countries because the dollar is the benchmark trading currency, you see. So if the dollar rises, other currencies fall. And certain countries are very much exposed in that regard, Turkey, South Africa, Latin American countries. So this thing could spill over in defaults and problems financially in the rest of the world. That needs to be watched very closely if this thing continues for any length of time. And it could very well continue for quite some time. So financial imperialism, to summarize, you know, is really about destroying the markets, the financial markets of a country, collapsing the currency of the country, right? Preventing and seizing the liquid assets of the country. That exacerbates the currency and the financial asset markets, right? Denying it bank access to bank credit in the West, denying it access to equity stock markets in the West, seizing, as I say, their liquid assets, seizing their real assets, you know, ships and planes and so forth, right? Forcing deflation of its assets in its own country, in its own currency, right? Denying it access to international payment systems, which do two things, prevent its access to currencies, foreign currencies, but also give an opportunity to see who's violating the sanctions. The sanctions are short-term, believe it or not. They're not long-term. Denying IMF loans and World Bank projects, trying to provoke defaults, right? Delisting from stock exchanges. These are all financial weapons that are used here. In financial imperialism. And the U.S. uses it very cleverly and very effectively. It's not so much the gross sanctions on goods flows that are the big weapon. It's the easier to implement, not perfect, but easier to implement more immediate impacts on financial markets and financial access to currencies and credit and so forth. That is the great weapon of financial imperialism. We saw it writ small here in Venezuela. Now it's being writ large in the case of Russia. Okay, so that's it for today. That's financial imperialism. That's my take on what's going on here. And we'll follow this more closely here in coming weeks. I'm out of here.